thank you for joining us for another episode of God, Law, and Liberty with David Fowler, President of the Family Action Council of Tennessee. Every week, we are putting culture, politics, and law on a collision course with the truth of God's Word. And now, here's David.
Thank you for joining me for today's episode of God, Law, and Liberty. I'm delighted to have you with me. And I want to speak today to the issue I raised last week about the need to disciple those who run for and hold elected office in terms of both theology and the history of law, the nature of law, and constitutional precepts that pertain to the office they want to hold. So, for example, obviously a person who wants to run for the Register of Deeds may not need to know the history of law and our Constitution at the same level as a person who wants to run for governor or for the state legislature or for Congress. That's what I mean by that. They need to be discipled in both areas. But today, I want to take a look at an example of what I think represents the failure of the church in this regard. Now, you'll recall last week I offered this thesis about discipleship and asked for some feedback, and I appreciate the feedback I got, but I gave myself a little critique. And I wanted to make sure that nobody understood what I was saying about discipling as meaning we only offer the gospel to those that we know are Christians or believe are going to become Christians, because I wasn't speaking of the offer of the gospel, which is to be offered to all, but only with respect to what should be done with those who respond to the offer, the discipleship and the nature of the kind of discipleship that's needed. And I mention this little caveat because in the early 1700s in Scotland, there was the Marrow controversy in the Presbytery of Auchterarder, and the doctrine of election had led some there into thinking the gospel should only be offered to the elect, which raised then the question of how a preacher of the gospel would know who the offer should be made to. So maybe none of you thought I was saying that, in which case, great, but in case you did, or you heard a critic of last week's episode say that's what they thought I was saying, well, that's not what I meant. And if you heard that, maybe you can tell my critic. Anyway, today I want to cover this interview from a few weeks ago, I think maybe 3 weeks ago, that Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council had with the pastor of a large church in Virginia after Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin signed legislation specifically requiring the issuance of marriage licenses without regard to sex and gender. Okay. Previously, they didn't have a statute requiring that. And Tony was focused on the word sex because the law essentially, expressly enacts same-sex marriage. And though I think the added word of gender is going to result in some biological man identifying as a woman and marrying a man as husband and wife, but that's not the issue for today. It'll just be interesting to see, and that's evidence of how messed up things are. But anyway, the issue that I want to look at is the state of discipleship in the church with respect to law and civil government, and see what we can learn from this interview that would be important to us going forward. Well, anyway, let me just go right to the interview. So I'm going to read some transcripts, a transcription of the interview or parts of it, because it may be copyrighted otherwise. So Tony opens the show with saying, well, in a move that surprised those on the right as well as those on the left, Republican Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin earlier this month signed into law HB 174, which establishes for the first time in Virginia state code the formal recognition and enforcement of so-called same-sex marriage. The decision prompted the pastor of one of the largest churches in Northern Virginia to reach out to the governor, who had spoken at the church. What can pastors glean from this, and how should we as Christians, as Bible-believing Christians, respond when our leaders betray the truth? Join me now in welcoming this pastor. So that's what he's doing, and that's really what I'm trying to do, is to say, what can we glean from this? What can we glean from this interview, specifically about the state of discipleship in our church? So Tony asked the pastor to, quote, set the stage, and can you tell us about your relationship with the governor prior to this bill? And at this point, the pastor proceeds to explain that he'd known the governor prior to his election and had brought him before his congregation on three separate occasions, saying, quote, as a believer, I was happy to put him forward in front of our congregation. And he explained why. Quote, I've always advocated for putting in front of our congregation candidates running for office who most closely align with our biblical worldview and our biblical values. And the pastor even noted on the night Youngkin was elected governor, Youngkin had the pastor pray before his acceptance speech. And Tony Perkins added that the governor had spoken at the Family Research Council's Pray Vote Stand events that had been hosted at this pastor's church. Now, here's the good part. The pastor said the following about his personal response to the governor after he signed the bill into law. Quote, I had a conversation with the governor. He was gracious enough to reply to my text. He sent a personal letter to me and our congregation, which I read, and then he called me to discuss the letter. Great. So he took action. He communicated with the governor. The governor responded. That's all wonderful. And that response was shared with the congregation. Now, here's what troubles me, though, and I'm going to read it and then explain what I find troubling. The pastor said this, quote, and to be fair, to be clear, his position, referring to Youngkin, is that this is only acknowledging what the U.S. Supreme Court decided with the Obergefell case, that same-sex marriage is acceptable in all 50 states. And then he added some protection for pastors and for churches. And so, you know, his position is this only speaks to marriage licenses, not the marriage ceremony itself. The bottom line, though, Tony, is what I said to the governor and what I told our congregation on Sunday. As a believer, for him to put his signature to a law, making it law, that is a clear violation of the higher moral standard of God's law, that's where I strongly disagree with what he did. And for believers to, you know what he's doing this, it felt like a betrayal. It felt like, well, we thought he was going to govern in a way that was consistent with our biblical values. And on this one, in my opinion, and that of a lot of folks like yourself, he got this one wrong. He's still a brother. Again, he's not a perfect person. We're all flawed. But he got this one wrong. And I just tell our folks, this is a good reminder. Put your confidence in the Lord, not in a political leader. They'll sometimes disappoint. As a pastor will sometimes disappoint. Like, we're flawed people, and so keep your eyes on Jesus. That's the bottom line message. Now, that may sound like a great conversation, and there at the end, great advice. And we certainly do want to put our confidence in the Lord and not political leaders, because they, like anybody else, including me, they're going to disappoint. But let me ask you this question. Would you put in the pulpit a pastor who had not studied the Bible and some of the great expositors of it over the centuries? I dare say you probably would not. So let me ask, why do we let pastors who've never been discipled in law and our form of government recommend candidates to their congregations and think that somehow it's not going to turn out as it did in this case? And why do we let Christians who've not been discipled theologically or in law and government and their history represent us in elected office and somehow think that's going to turn out well, too? Now, as to the first, and this is the opinion I'm coming to, is that if pastors have not developed a biblical theology of governments and jurisdictions and the nature of law and its functions, and how that applies to our specific form of dual governments, federal and state, well, then maybe they shouldn't be putting any Christian political candidates who will be involved in the development of public policy and positive law in front of their church, because they'll have no idea how to evaluate whether that candidate is fit for that kind of office in civil government. But yet, that's what most pastors do. They check a candidate's moral values to see if they're consistent with those found in the Bible, and maybe look at how the candidate answers narrow questions on a candidate survey. And for that pastor, that qualifies the candidate. Put them in front of the church. And sadly, I think that's true of a number of public policy organizations that evaluate and recommend candidates. They don't get at the depth of their worldview and their understanding of the nature and history of law and civil government. Now, let's take a look here. How did this bad law come about? Well, it came about precisely because, as Youngkin admitted, the state of Virginia had already accepted the United States Supreme Court's decision in Obergefell versus Hodges in 2015 as the law of the land. That's what he said, didn't he? I mean, Hamrick even said, to be fair, the governor was only acknowledging what the U.S. Supreme Court decided with the Obergefell case. The same-sex marriage is acceptable in all 50 states. Now, had Youngkin been discipled in regard to law, and specifically our nation's laws and their history, he would have known the relationship between the two types of governments in our nation. He would have known that the U.S. Constitution and the powers of the federal government are based on positively declared law, just like statutes, though they rest on the common law. And he would have known that the states, however, except for Louisiana, are common law jurisdictions, which is a different kind of jurisdictional authority, not positive law granted jurisdictions, and that they are entitled to have state constitutions, and for those to rest on the common law as well, and that their laws and their constitution are fine and to be enforced except where federal and state laws conflict, in which case the U.S. Constitution controls. Now, that's a mouthload, or I guess I should say mouthful, and you may need to run that back a few times and get that I'm pointing out here that I don't think Governor Youngkin understands any of that very well, or not well enough. And the undiscipled Youngkin and the undiscipled pastor would say in response to what I just said, yeah, but David, there's the rub. You see, the state constitution and the state laws that define marriage as one man and one woman, they conflict with the federal law. And as you said, federal law controls. And that's where I would then say, and you clearly have not been discipled to comment on what Youngkin did, or discipled to know that Youngkin doesn't know what he's doing. If Youngkin had been discipled in preparation for the office he holds, he would have known that under the U.S. Constitution, only Congress can make a law. And a court judgment, even from SCOTUS, is never law within the meaning of the separation of powers in the U.S. Constitution. And if Governor Youngkin had been discipled in preparation for the office he holds, he would have known that no federal court could ever amend a state law permitting licenses to be issued only to a man and a woman, so that it could allow licenses to be issued to two men and two women. He would have known the Supreme Court decision could have never done that. And he would have known that at best, the Supreme Court's decision could only mean that the state couldn't issue any marriage licenses at all. And if Governor Youngkin had been discipled in preparation for the office he holds, he would have known that his state has been violating the state law for the last 9 years. So it should have never been issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples as a matter of law, because their law doesn't provide for it. And to the extent that's in conflict with the U.S. Constitution, they can't issue any licenses until they have a new law. Therefore, Youngkin's whole justification for signing the new law goes right down the toilet. And if the pastor had ever been discipled in these matters, he would have pointed these very things out to Youngkin never offered the excuse to his congregation that he gave him that, well, he was just acknowledging the U.S. Supreme Court decided, and he would have never allowed him to make a distinction between marriage licenses and not the marriage ceremony itself. I mean, that latter part is a compartmentalizing of law. It'd be like saying the law of slavery was only about government-approved dehumanizing of people, not the people themselves. I didn't own any slaves, and I didn't think of them badly. It's just the law did, and, well, that's okay. We can compartmentalize that. I mean, if you're married in Virginia, you have to have a license. So Youngkin's ceremony distinction, that offered on his behalf by the pastor, is meaningless. The ceremony doesn't matter one bit in the eyes of the law, only the license. So what a terrible message to communicate to God's people, that they can compartmentalize law and reality in such a way. And I dare say, if Tony Perkins knows those things, then perhaps he should have given more thought to putting this kind of sloppy, legal, constitutional, theologically compartmentalized thinking from a pastor out there for Christians to absorb. I mean, in my opinion, the pastor should have been asked if he brought these things up to Youngkin. And if so, what did Youngkin say? So that we know just who Youngkin really is. But if the concern is that asking those kind of questions of the pastor might embarrass the pastor, well, then perhaps he shouldn't have been interviewed at all. And a podcast could have been done to help clarify the problem in the church of pastors who are undiscipled in the area of law and government, and elected officials who are undiscipled with respect not only to perhaps their theology, but to the office they hold. So here's the problem, and the one for which I offered my thesis last week. We must start discipling those who aspire to hold public office so their convictions before God are firm about what God says, and they don't melt away under undiscipled understandings of law and the duties of their office. Now, simply supplement that thesis with this one. Pastors who are going to put politicians before their congregations in ways that might imply an endorsement, they need to be discipled, not to look only at the candidate's moral compass and whether the candidate's made some profession of a reason to faith that may or may not have entailed the saving faith of regeneration by the Holy Spirit and conversion to a true new man. No, they need to make sure those candidates and office holders are properly discipled theologically and in terms of what's required for their office and how to hold that office as a Christian. And to be honest, only maybe a minister or two that I know of many could disciple a person in that way. And I suspect few churches even have a member who could provide that kind of discipleship. But I would say to the broader Christian community, we need to have at least some believer in every community who's able to do that for the sake of the body of Christ in that community. In fact, I would suspect a pastor who could provide that kind of discipleship and who, in this case, had a relationship with Youngkin might have called the governor back in 2015 after the Obergefell decision came out and asked him then what he was going to do, and ask how he could help the governor find a way to challenge what they both would say is a moral wrong. Now, some today, maybe not the persons who listen to this podcast, would say, well, that's outside the call of a minister to make that kind of call. But it can't be if the minister is going to invite candidates to their church in a way that implies their endorsement. And it can't be, in this instance, because this pastor called the governor when the new statute was enacted. So he's willing to be engaged with the candidate. So why wait 9 years to say something to the governor about what the state of Virginia was admittedly already doing for 9 years that was morally and constitutionally wrong? See, the pastor who's going to engage in these things can't then turn around and say, well, that's making those phone calls after decisions like Obergefell and continuing to follow up after Obergefell. Well, that's outside the role of the minister. Nope, can't do that. If you're going to have these candidates come inside your church and imply your endorsement, can't have your cake and eat it too. So I hate to sound critical, but the trumpet on this issue sounded the call to battle 9 years ago. And that was the time this pastor and every other God-fearing pastor in America, properly discipled in more than soteriology, should have been calling governors and legislators, insisting they look for a constitutionally and legally sound way to challenge what was a clear wrong. But there's a greater problem here than just with pastors. And this is what I've gleaned from, the last 29 years, that Christian policy and legal leaders are just as guilty as this pastor. And neither the organization interviewing this pastor or any other national legal advocacy or policy advocacy organization or any state organization other than the one I lead here in Tennessee has even looked for answers to Obergefell. They all acquiesced and moved on. And this interview tells me we have a long way to go if we want to disciple the nations. Now, let me end with a bit of hope. One national organization, not known as a legal advocacy organization and even relatively new to public policy, has been talking to me and a couple of legal academics for the last year and a half or 2 years. In late April, they hosted the only gathering of lawyers and ministers that I know of to consider how to best go about challenging the Obergefell decision. Wasn't a large group. And those who've shown no interest in this subject for 9 years, they weren't invited. You know, it's sort of like the Gideon's army, right? If you're not drinking with one hand and holding the sword with another, you're not ready to come. Go home. If you haven't expressed any interest in this issue for 9 years and you're still not expressing it, particularly after, you know, I've reached out to you multiple times and you say, no, go away. Well, no point in calling them to the battle, right? So the goal was to build a Gideon's army of those people who are coming to see that Obergefell is the greatest God-denying anthropological disaster in the history of our nation's jurisprudence. And that group is going to meet again in December, and perhaps God would bring us some others who have a passion for this. You can be praying for that meeting, if you would, and for God to raise up a few more people to join us, and that would be much appreciated. So, thank you for joining me for today, and I hope you'll join me next week for the next episode of God, Law, and Liberty.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the podcast. And if you want to help spread the word, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe too. God, Law, and Liberty is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information, please visit us at www.facttennessee.org. That's FACTennessee.org. And please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at FACTennessee.